Welcome to the Mentors Podcast, where we meet the men and women who mentored Western civilization. This is Dr. Roseanne Welch. For more information, visit mentorsproject.org. Today's guest is Dr. Jule Selbel, author of Dreams of Discovery, a novel based on the life of John Cabot, who discovered the coast of North America under a commission by Henry VII. Since he was sponsored by the English, his name has gone down in history as John Cabot, when in fact he was an Italian explorer born in Genoa, so we ought to know him by his given name, Giovanni Cabato. I suppose that's the reason he was ripe for a new book about his exploits. Welcome, Jule.
Hello, Roseanne. Nice to be here.
It's lovely to talk about all these very fascinating people.
Yes.
Okay, my first question always is, why does John Cabot or Giovanni Cabato matter to us today?
Well, I think it's very interesting. When mentors asked me to do this book, I knew a little bit about the Cabot Trail, Cabot's landing in Canada, Newfoundland, Nova Scotia. He's very well known on the East Coast. But I didn't realize that he had sailed only 5 years after Columbus. And Columbus, sailing for Spain, went south and ended up in Cuba and below Florida area.
Right, Dominican Republic and Haiti and all that.
Right. And so he had a different experience, and he came back, and Columbus was somebody who really loved to do the social media of the day. He did pamphlets about himself. He did talks. He did gave himself parades, and the kings and queens gave him parades. But John Cabot, only 5 years later, thought, well, okay, let me see what happens if I go on a more northerly route. And he convinced Henry VII that that was viable. And so he landed, we think, on Newfoundland, Nova Scotia. And then if you really dig down deep, which I had to for this book, which was so much fun, there's some people who think that eventually he went all the way on his second voyage. He went all the way down almost to Virginia, North Carolina. There's even some people, researchers, scholars, who believe that he got much further south. But while he was doing it, he was planting the flag for England. And at the time, Henry VII was very disappointed when Cabot came back because there was no gold, there were no riches. There were none of the Asian riches that everybody expected, because Cabot, the same as Columbus, they both thought that they had landed on the coast of China or in Asia somewhere.
Oh, that's interesting. So he thought the same thing, even though Columbus had already been here. He still thought he'd made it around.
Yeah, when Cabot died, he still thought he had gotten to the coast of Asia, and Columbus, you know, towards India and the Asian part. So both of the men died thinking that they had reached the shores. Because they didn't come back with riches, nobody paid that much attention. But, you know, fast forward 100 years, when colonization really took hold, you have all these maps, flags of England down the coast, the east coast of America. And so England all of a sudden was rich in land and colonies. So I think he's really important for us to think about, because we do speak America's language is English. There were more English colonies than any other countries in the United States area. So a difference of 5 years, Columbus, yes, he did the sailing first, but at the same time, Cabot's long-lasting legacy may be greater.
That's very interesting. I don't think that I have ever heard or thought about that before. We grant that it was the colonists who created this as an English colony more than we think about the explorer who planted flags, just like our guys planted flags on the moon.
Right, right.
Now, you said something very interesting to me, which was there are scholars who believe this and scholars who believe that and scholars who think he got as far south as Virginia. How did you, as an author, decide what you were going to have happen in his story as you perceived
it? Well, it's interesting, as all writers do, and historical fiction is so exciting in that way, is you read a lot, you do a lot of research. You start to pick out where you see the same things that more and more scholars agree with. You start discrediting some of the books and articles that you read where some of the facts and dates the research doesn't seem as deep and it starts not sounding right. Cabot's so interesting because he wasn't well researched for a long time. And there was a group in England at the University of Bristol, and that's where he sailed from when he came to England. That's where he lived with his family. And so the University of Bristol has kind of embraced John Cabot. And there was one researcher, a very famous researcher, a woman, who at some point people started getting interested in Cabot. And she said, "Back off, everyone. This is mine. I'm going to do the John Cabot research." And she was very well respected. And so everyone backed off. And she had a book contract. She was going to publish in a year. Well, 3 years went by, 7 years went by, and she was still gathering information and telling little bits and pieces to everybody, but not enough to give a full picture of John Cabot. Well, she died before she published this book.
Of course.
And in her will, she asked her assistant to destroy all of her research that had not yet been published. And she put in a fee to make sure that the assistant would do it. Well, the assistant shredded all of her research right after she died. So everything was destroyed.
What a waste.
Yes. And this woman had kind of kept a lot of it to herself. So the University of Bristol has a department, and they've harnessed a lot of their energies into putting together Cabot's story again, using a little bits and pieces of what this woman had, but basically they had to start from scratch again. So they have collected a lot of the research. So I tended to trust them because they've dug the deepest. There's a book by Douglas Hunter that came out that kind of compared Columbus and Cabot that was really exceptionally well researched. But other than that, that was the only strong, really, I felt, valid research to jump off from. Not only do you research the life of the person, you end up researching the historical times.
That's the most interesting part.
Right. And so what made him want to do all this? Who were his competitors? How did he live? How did he make money? What was his family like? What was it like living in Genoa, where he was born, and then the family moving to Venice? And then he had to abscond from Venice because he got in some financial troubles, and he moved to Catalonia. So then he was kind of under, it wasn't quite Spain yet, but we can just say Spanish rule. The Inquisition was happening, all the stuff. And then finally deciding, I can't get money from Spain to go explore because Columbus has got that. Portugal is already given their money to Vasco da Gama and a lot of other people. And England was the only other country that was doing this kind of exploration. So he moved his family to England so that he could finally get in front of a king and say, "Listen to me, I've got a great idea."
That is the part that fascinates me, that he had to go that far in order to do the thing he wanted to do, which also means learning the language from scratch.
Absolutely. And he had to learn Italian, well, Genoese, which was different from Venetian language when his family moved to Venice. But, you know, it was still Italian. Then he had to learn Spanish, and then the family had to learn English. And what's interesting for Columbus and for Cabot is because Italy wasn't Italy at the time.
Correct. It was not a united country. There was several kingdoms.
Yeah. So there was no entity that was strong enough or rich enough to send out their own explorers. So Italian explorers had to go to different nations.
That makes a lot of sense, and it's something we don't talk about often when we're considering these men and why they went where and where they got their money from and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, the other thing that I found fascinating in the research is I just figured, okay, you get a king to say, yeah, you can sail for me. And you think, okay, well, then they handed over a blank check, or they gave them, you know, X amount of gold or whatever. The countries themselves, Portugal, Spain, England, rarely financed the explorations. They gave you their patronage. So that meant that you could fly their flag on your ship, which would keep the pirates away because no one wanted to go to war with these nations. So the pirates would stay away. But once the king would say yes to you, then you had to go find the money and put together how to pay the crew, how to get all the food and things that you needed on the ship, etc.
So you needed your own GoFundMe program long before they existed.
Absolutely.
That's something also that I don't think we take into consideration. We assume that the kings just handed over the cash and said, bring back what you find.
I know, that's what I thought when I started it, and I was going, oh, this is very interesting.
So what would make a person want to take that kind of risk? What made Cabot so desirous of being an explorer and having that experience in his life?
Well, I think part of it was probably growing up in Genoa, which is right, obviously, on the water. And there wasn't really a tradition of explorers from there. This whole age of discovery that Cabot was born into was really just started around that time in the early 1400s when people wanted to expand where they could gain wealth. And Portugal led it for a long time. There was a prince called Prince Henry the Navigator. He was never king of Portugal, but he was related to King Alfonso V. And he was really into it. He started his own school in Portugal, and if you could get your wherewithal together, you could go study there. Cabot came from a poor, not a poor family. His dad was a merchant, but they were not noble, they were not rich. But his dad being on the wharf all the time in Genoa gave him the opportunity to meet the sailors, meet the captains, see all these people who had these dreams. And I think Cabot's desire just grew from that. He was also a kid, I think, my version of John Cabot, who loved maps. He was very smart. He loved the sense of adventure. So, in writing these historical fiction novels, it falls to the author sometimes to create characters to help support the vision that we have of these people. So, in Genoa, where he lived between age 1 and 10, I created a character named Signor Faglio, who had a map bookstore, a map store. So I would have Giovanni Cabato, John Cabot, hang out there. And that's where he meets Christopher Columbus
Oh,
when he's 10
wonderful.
years old.
And did he really meet him in real life?
Well, yes.
Ah, that's more of wonderful.
We don't have hard evidence that they ever crossed paths in Genoa when they were young boys. But Columbus was also interested in maps. His brother Bartholomew was a map maker and wanted to be a map maker since he was a little kid. So it made sense to me that they could cross paths in Signor Faglio's map store.
In such a, and of course, maps were the commodity of the time. Maps were, that's where Amerigo Vespucci comes from and all of that.
They cross in the book at age 10, but then they don't see each other for 30 some years. But one of the things that I found most interesting when I did the research is there are a couple of scholars who really believed that Cabato sailed with Columbus on the second expedition to America.
Oh, if only could prove that.
I know. And the thing is, there's notes where John Cabot Cabato alleged that and said that. And why shouldn't we believe him? It could have been something that would have been very easily found out.
Back in his own day, right? Why would he make a lie like that?
And he had become by this time a harbor surveyor and designer. He had sailed to Istanbul and to the east. He had never captained a ship, but he had been gone on these trips. And he had also become in Venice. He had taken on some real estate work that he wanted to do to build up his financial wealth so that he could someday, get his own ship, which he never did. But he would excavate the swamps and the water, the narrow waters of Venice, and build buildings and sell them or rent them. So he knew a lot about the sea, the harbor making, and all that kind of stuff. So he was actually hired to design a harbor for the King of Spain, King Ferdinand at the time, in Valencia. So it makes sense that the king would then say, okay, you go with Columbus on the second voyage because we're going to need harbors there.
Of course. Oh, that's fascinating. So obviously you put that in the book. Wow. And I don't think anyone considers the second voyage of Columbus. We're all concerned with the first voyage.
Well, the second voyage was tough. And that's when I think Columbus started getting in trouble, which nobody ever really talked about in America for a long time.
Right.
It was the third voyage of Columbus where he was, you know, put in chains, and his crew mutinied, put him in chains, and sent him back to Spain, kind of a ruined man. So yes, it was first, second, and third, and then Columbus, I think was working on getting a fourth expedition when he died. I don't think he actually got it, but I could be wrong.
That was his plan. Okay, that's very interesting to see the two of them. So if we're thinking about relationships that form character when you're writing a historical novel, who were the other relationships in Giovanni's life that fueled him?
Well, it's interesting because you always, as an author, you kind of go, well, do you mean the real ones or are the ones that have been made up for the story to make sense?
Oh, both of them.
Yeah, the real ones, I think, are very important. Is his wife, Matea. She was a woman who didn't stay home while he had all these adventures. When he said, I have to get to out of Venice because I'm in financial trouble. I'm sorry. You know, you go live with your family. She said, no. The family sticks together. And she went with him to Catalonia and then to Valencia. And then when he saw the opportunity in England, she said, well, no, we're all going with you. And that's documented. She and his three sons. So the way that I approached him, because of these kinds of facts that I found, I think family was really important to him. So he had his wife, Matea, his son, Sebastian, who has become famous also as an explorer. His older son never became an explorer, but I think worked in the financial part of raising money. And then Sancius, his younger son, there was never really that much I could find out about him.
Interesting. So finances made a very strong contribution to that family. Obviously, he would probably have helped his father get the money to get boats and men and payroll.
I think so, because his Cabot's also a really important relationship was his brother Piero, who is historically correct. And they seem to have stayed together their whole life, too. So I just think that family was his source of solace, excitement. I have in the book where he tasks his family, okay, you do the research on that. You research the King of England. You research Spain. You bring me everything I need so that we can all profit by these moves that we make.
And that makes perfect sense because families did. I mean, even if we go down to factory days, families did piecemeal work in order to make more money for the whole family.
Yeah. And then there's some really important people that he meets once or twice in the book. And there was a wonderful guy that I discovered in the research called Father Mauro. And he was a monk, but he had been an explorer and he'd been in the army and stuff like that. And had the calling to join the monkhood, the monastery. But he retained his love of travel and maps and stuff. And in 1450, he drew the Frau Maurer map. It's in Venice at the Doge's palace. And it's really one of the things that now I need to go back to Venice to see because I didn't see it when I was there. It was just about 4 meters square, as I understand it. I've seen pictures in books and stuff, but it's a map of the world as it was then. And it was pretty good for a 1450 map of what was the world and what people thought the world was going to be.
The known
but
world.
Not only was it just a map, there was meticulous drawings of towers and castles. He even had the Garden of Eden in one corner. I have as Giovanni, one of Giovanni's desires is to meet Frau Mauro when he goes to Venice. And he has to go, you know, yes, great obstacles, but he finally meets this monk who lives in a monastery where nobody gets to get in. So there's people like that that really inspired him.
I love that idea of finding who the inspirations were and then trying to give them life since they're the kinds of characters who've been even more lost through history.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
How cool. Well, so tell me what was your impression of Cabot before you started researching him and then what ideas you came to have about him as a person when you were done?
Well, I didn't have any ideas of actually what kind of person he was. I had never crossed my mind to even think about it. And then I started doing the research, and I came to believe that he was a guy who could, he was a good talker. he enjoyed talking, he enjoyed learning, he was smart. There is research, very valid research, that when he moved to Venice, because the family was not noble, they hadn't lived in Venice for a long time. When you moved to Venice at that time, you could move there, but you could not be a citizen for 15 years. So you couldn't vote, you couldn't be in the guilds, you couldn't do all this stuff, and you couldn't even try to get into the really good schools. But there's research that Giovanni Cabato did get into one of these really, really top schools after he'd been in Venice for like 2 or 3 years. So then as a writer, I go, well, he must have been smart. He must have impressed the right people. But then you go, okay, here's this kid from a family that's not, you know, socially elite among all of these elite kids, and he's seen as smart. He's doing really well in school. And of course, there's going to be resentment from his peers because he doesn't belong there. So you have all that stuff that you learn about a person, and then you start building their character. Because he could talk his way into the King of England, because he could talk his way into seeing King Ferdinand and doing work for him, I thought, okay, this is a guy who can present himself well. And then you have a choice as a writer. Is he a guy that's annoying, who talks a lot?
Too pushy, right?
Or is he a guy who actually is sincere, does his work, is dogged, never gives up? And ultimately, I think that's who he was, because people trusted him, and men would sail with him.
True. That's so fascinating. Obviously, we're discussing a lot this concept of writing and creating characters. So I'm going to have to ask you, what background did you bring to this, both as a writer and perhaps just your other interest in life, that made you a great fit for writing about Giovanni?
Like you, Roseanne, I've done a lot of work as a screenwriter. And I think one of my favorite jobs was working with George Lucas on Young Indiana Jones Chronicles. And it kept reminding me when I was going through the research on John Cabot how much I love research. And when I was working with George Lucas, we would be given reams and reams of research. And the conceit of that show is that most of these characters are going to be real people, and the only fictional character is Indiana Jones. And so we wanted to bring as much of the reality of the times and the other characters to the fore, but make it exciting and interesting television experience. So I think that knowing that I really loved doing that, it made me excited about wanting to do John Cabot. So that's from the screenwriter side. And then as a professor, again, I just love research. And I love to kind of dig in and try to figure out what life was like at a certain time, why people did what they did during those certain times. So I think as a screenwriter working on those kind of historical shows, and then as a professor, it was just a really great combination for me to get involved with this.
Wow. And did you have a chance to visit any locations that suited the piece, or in general, any places even in the States that were places he had landed?
Well, I was lucky enough to teach in Florence, Italy for on and off for 3 years. And so without even knowing it, before I even started on Cabot, I had done a lot of the Italian research, and I had been to Venice, and I had been to different areas. And then once I started working on Cabot, I was also teaching in Italy. So I went to Genoa and hung out there. It wasn't really on my top list of places to go for some reason before I started working on Cabot. It's a fabulous place, so much different than Venice and Florence, which are beautiful and historic, but kind of feel like they've now been a little buffed and shined
touristy
for the tourist.
Right.
And Genoa still is very blue collar and edgy, and the alleyways are narrow, and the sense of the bustling harbor and the diversity and the people coming there from all different nations. And just to think that that was probably very similar to what it was like then was very exciting. As far as in America, I had been to Spain a couple of times when I was a student at university. I did a couple of semesters in Spain, basically probably just to get out of, you know, away from my parents or something. But but that just turned out fine too, because I had been to some of the areas that John Cabot had spent some time. And as far as the East Coast of the United States, I've always loved the East Coast and the coastline. My husband's a sailor. And that was another reason why I got very excited about doing this book, because I thought, you know, I'm not a sailor, and I'm going to have to learn so much about sailing. So the book goes into how he learned navigation. So, of course, I'm learning it at the same time that I'm writing it and getting the sailors here to check and make sure I had it right. So it was really fun to kind of put all those different locations together.
That's the fun of writing this kind of work, definitely. So now you're making me wonder, in terms of a historical fiction, and you don't have everything you need, and you have to invent some stuff in order to tie things together, what would you say is your favorite scene that you had to create?
Going to the monastery to see Fra Mauro was a lot of fun. Creating the romantic arc for Giovanni Cabato was really fun too, because Matea in this book does come from a noble family, and she's very smart, and she is kind of bursting at the seams because she wants adventure too, and that's not something that's available to a young woman in the 1400s. So how they got together, how her curiosity about life and his curiosity about different places kind of merged together, and then building how the family was built, and then how they all decided to keep on going towards this dream together was really fun. Another character that I created for it was a sailor who had lost a leg on a voyage, and he came back to Venice and opened up a chart shop. And Giovanni volunteers to run errands for him in exchange to learning how to do charts. And I learned the difference between maps and charts, which was really interesting for me, because maps, you know, kind of give more of an overview, but a chart will tell you the depth of the water, you know, where you can find fruit, where you can, you know, put your ship, where, you know, where the rocks are and all that. So those differences were really fun. And then I ended up taking a class in Portland, Maine on chart making. And so now I can get on a boat and I can read a chart, you know, which is all very exciting.
Oh, that is. That is. Well, it's part of how the character infuses you and you infuse the character.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. Well, so think about the idea of what sort of theme did you find running through his life that you were able to use as the spine of putting all this massive amount of research into one solid story? What themes ran through his life?
I think he had a strong goal, and I think that drove him. The theme became something about doing it in the right way, making sure that you didn't leave family and friends behind. So the themes of the book, really it's adventure, it's curiosity. He was born in the age of discovery, but that was exploration. Vasco da Gama was going around Africa. Everybody was trying to find a way to the Far East because the Turks had basically super control of the Silk Road, and they were taxing people, and it was dangerous, and they were controlling all the riches that everybody wanted to bring back to their nations from China and India. The curiosity to try to find another way around to get to this Far East was driving a lot of people in the age of discovery. But at the same time, it was also a period, it was the Inquisition. So there was kind of the fear, and there was very, very conservative religious edicts. And so it was an interesting combination of expansion of knowledge of what's out there, where the ideas were still kept very close to home and you had to act a certain way. So that the whole thing of how the discovery worked in this time period was interesting to me.
Sounds like an expansion of discovery, but also a contraction in fear of what that discovery might prove or what it might change about their beliefs of the world.
Yeah, yeah. Because a book that I'm working on now takes place during the Enlightenment, where you're supposed to question. You're supposed to reach out. The whole thing is, well, that's what somebody said a month ago or 2 years ago or 100 years ago, but let's make sure that it's really that now, whereas that was not happening during Cabot's time.
Interesting. Okay, well, then I'm going to wrap it out with a couple of questions I like to ask people to think about the themes of the Mentoris program, which are, who were the mentors in his life? And then, who were the mentors in your life?
Well, I think the mentors in John Cabot's life, his father was a family man who was a merchant and was very hardworking and kept the family together. And I think that was very important to him. And then along the way, this is someone that I've created, one of the professors at the school that he gets to go to, really took him under his wing. I guess that in the long run, those would be the strongest mentors because they're the ones who kind of help shape him and give him the confidence. And along the way, because he moved from Genoa to Venice to Catalonia to Valencia and then England, and at that time, you didn't like pick up a phone and talk to your mentor.
True.
And letters even at, you know, took a long time. And at when he was in Catalonia, he was in hiding, so he couldn't reach out to his mentors from Venice. So, but along the way, he always found someone to share his dream and to help him move forward. There was another priest, Father Carbonaris, who he met when he did an exploratory trip to Bristol when he was still a merchant for his father. And along the way, this father helped him get in front of the King of England. So that speaks to why I think he made good friendships. People trusted him. People enjoyed being with him, and they were willing to help him. So he along the way, he found a series of mentors that I think that helped him.
And you?
Mentors for me. Well, I think that I probably always go back to my eighth grade teacher. His name was Ted Larson, and he taught film and speech at my junior high school. And he was just a very creative guy who had a lot of energy, who there was nothing he thought we couldn't do. He had us making films. We were writing them, directing them, editing them, acting in them, doing the whole thing. We were putting on plays. And it was perfect for me because that's where I found my passion for film, theater, television. And he just stuck with me my whole life. I left, you know, all through high school, he would always check in on me. When I went to college, he would check in on me. And then even when I moved to Hollywood and I was working at Warner Brothers, there was a knock on my office door one day. And the assistant said, a guy named Ted Larson is here. And I was like, what? And he had come in for some film festival. And he was always just a guy who believed in me and we were always interested in kind of forging forward in the passions that we had for film and television.
Oh, that's a beautiful theme for us to end on today. I have to thank you so much for being with us. It was fascinating to hear more about Giovanni and about you.
Well, thank you, Roseanne. This has been fun.
We'll hopefully have everyone pick up their own copy of Dreams of Discovery, a novel based on the life of John Cabot, and we will talk to you soon.
Thank you, Roseanne.
Thanks for listening to the Mentoris Podcast, sponsored by the Barbera Foundation, whose mission is to promote positive change by inspiring others to engage in their community. Your host has been Dr. Roseanne Welch. Our music was composed by Patrick Abate, technical direction by Douglas E. Welch, and Kathleen Childress designed our website. For more information and to read more about the great mentors in history, visit mentorsproject.org and join us for our next conversation.